We welcome in our friend, the talented writer, author, Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Kimball?
Well, just making our way through a Tuesday here, doing the thing. I know we're going to talk John Lennon a little bit, but kind of like the Red Sox. 8-0 start to spring training, and then have lost 14 of their last 20.
I didn't know any of that. I was lost in the spring training. It just goes on for so long. It seems like, I guess it doesn't really in a way, but compared to the other sports, it seems like they get to camp a couple days in, they're having an exhibition game, and then before you know it, it's the regular season. Baseball spring training goes on and on and on and on. But I strongly suspect that this time next week, Chris Sale will be hurt and out of the lineup. At least I won't have to watch him and see his act. But are you bullish on this season? How do you think they do?
I think they do better than people expect. And I think the way we've watered down the postseason, I think they might be in contention for one of those wild card spots. But I don't know. They've got so many holes, so many question marks, so many things that have to go well. It was funny. We were talking to one of the Boston sports writers a couple of weeks ago about Corey Kluber getting the opening day start. And the best reason I've ever heard for it, it was going to be too much pressure on Chris Sale. He just didn't want all that pressure of having to make that opening day start. So that's what they paid him all that money for.
I think it's his birthday, too. They wanted him to enjoy his birthday. It's not a good look. They have too many, I think, bullpen guys that they've moved into the rotation. And the bullpen, as you know, the way starting pitching works now, bullpen guys are more valuable than ever. I think that's backwards. It's funny, though, because I was thinking about that 1970 Red Sox team, because I had sent you that clip from YouTube the other day. There was a clip that was discovered of the bulk of a Red Sox Tigers game from April 1970. And the Red Sox, they were so patchy with when they would make the postseason, because so few teams made the postseason, but they had all of these years where they were pretty good, but not quite enough good. 1970, 71, we know about 72, 73, 74. They were the same kind of team with the same kind of record every year, and they would have been in the wild card running now. But back then, you just thought of them as this team that failed. So it's strange in a way how success and failure, you can have the exact same record, be the exact same kind of team, and it gets looked at differently depending upon what era that you happen to be in.
Thank you, by the way, for sharing that video from 1970. That was a blast. I'm pretty sure, like I told you, I bet I watched that live back as a youngster. But it was great to hear Ned Martin again, and Johnny Pesky doing color, and some players I'd forgotten about, like Eddie Phillips of Maine.
Yeah, and he was someone who, like I was saying to you, it speaks to how difficult it is to make the major leagues. I think the example I gave you was Tim Salmon. People are so cavalier, among other things, on social media. Someone will have a career like Tim Salmon, where they have 300 home runs and 1,000 RBI, and people will dismiss that as solid career. It wasn't solid. Do you know what the chances of being like Tim Salmon are? So this particular player that you mentioned never had a career win. And he was just there for this compact amount of time, a little bit, not even the whole run or half of the 1970 season. So he was number 27. I don't know if there's someone after him. It's unlikely. He was 27 before Fisk was 27. And much as I love Carlton Fisk, even I didn't know what number Fisk wore when he debuted for a couple games in 1969. So he was there in 69. And he doesn't come around again until 71, but he's a rookie in 72. Very strange. But it was how he was able to play in four decades. So in case anyone has a burning need to know, the answer is Fisk was 40 in 69. And 40 was a number, apparently, that they gave to players that they didn't expect to stick around that long. Although Dwight Evans was 40 at one point. Who was the guy? Benintendi was 40. So it's not like a terrible number to have, but they don't really hold out a lot of optimism for your success if they're giving you that.
I loved it. I had no idea. That was great stuff. Well, let's talk a little John Lennon. And John Lennon guitar work, because I think, fairly or not, when people think of the Beatles and guitar, the first person they think of is George Harrison.
Right. They do think of Harrison, and they probably should think of Paul McCartney, who was the most talented guitarist in the Beatles, but he didn't play lead guitar all that often. There are only three or four examples. With McCartney, you have the guitar solo on Taxman. It was George Harrison's song. Harrison couldn't have played that guitar solo. That's a guitar solo you could excise off of Revolver, and you could paste that into Fresh Cream or Are You Experienced, and you wouldn't think that Clapton or Hendrix was having an off solo, as it were. Harrison played most of the guitar solos, especially in the early era of the Beatles. And what he would do is he would reemphasize the melody. That's what he tended to stick to. And Harrison, by his own admission, was a guitarist who didn't practice that much. Frankly, I don't think George Harrison tried that hard. I think if there was someone who was, they all needed to be in the group. They were all integral to the mix that they had as a foursome. But if there was the kind of least valuable Beatle, it was going to be Harrison, or maybe not least valuable, most replaceable if it came to that. I think they would have had a hard time replacing the contribution that Ringo Starr provided as a drummer. When they got Starr, everything that needed to click into place clicked into place. And then you have the two guys up front. I mean, who are they? They're Gretzky and Messier. They're Jordan and Pippen. I mean, you need the both if you're going to be the Beatles. But something that's never discussed, they're very rarely discussed, and that's why I want to talk about it. It's not written about. I think people don't have a clue about is the guitar playing of John Lennon, which I think was quite important to the band. And even though he wasn't a regular soloist, and he was by no means a technician, he is one of my favorite guitar players, sounds strange, of all time.
Well, and let's listen to a little bit from some early Beatles, 1964. Let's check out some of All My Loving, and let's hear a little of the solo on that from John Lennon.
We have that's Harrison on the solo.
Oh.
Throughout the song, the triplets that you hear being played, that rapid guitar figure that goes throughout the entire song, it's not quite a riff, but it's going to play from start to end at that frantic pace.
Well, let's listen. Let's check out a little bit then. Listen for that part. Oh yeah, there it is. So what was Lennon's skill as a guitarist? How would you rate it, and what was he best at?
Technically, quite limited. He himself said that, I have to clean up the language, but he could make the guitar scream and howl. What I would say is you usually knew it was John Lennon. He was a person of some real inner torment, and I'm not suggesting that he was Charlie Patton or Robert Johnson on the guitar, but his guitar playing picked up on that psychological component that he had. It was scabrous. It was intense. It was driving. Now, the thing that makes All My Loving notable is it's one of the first major contributions as a songwriter from Paul McCartney. I mean, it's like a big kind of number for him. And the reason the song works in large part is because Lennon was able to play those triplets. So he's not technically proficient for the most part, but it's not easy to be playing those triplets. So it's like one of those moments from him where you think, huh, wow, I didn't know you could do that. And he probably didn't know he could do that too, but the Beatles, for everything that they're going to do as songwriters, and for all of the work that they do as virtuosic singers built off of the songwriting, you have a foundation with the band. And a lot of that foundation, I mean, really, the bulk of that foundation, I think this would surprise people, is Lennon's rhythm playing. Starr gets talked about as this timekeeper, and he does nothing else. That's not true. Starr provides a lot of coloration in the Beatles' music throughout their entire career in different ways, whether it's with cymbal washes or that weird style of fills he had that would always work. But Starr, he was an impeccable timekeeper, but he provided a lot of rhythmic accents as well. He was not freed up to do what he, well, he wouldn't have been able to do it anyway, but for instance, in The Who, Pete Townsend freed up Keith Moon to play what was the lead instrument of the band. It was lead drums. It wasn't lead guitar. And that's not the same with Ringo Starr, but the reason that Starr could provide a lot of the accents that he did was because of Lennon's rhythm guitar play.
Well, whatever chops Lennon had, how much of that do you think was learned when they were playing in the clubs, particularly playing in Hamburg?
I think quite a bit. That and also before that, I think the guitar for Lennon, I don't just point out that Harrison was a lazy musician to slag him off. It's sort of also to emphasize that from a young age, in an impressionable age, with everything he was going through in his personal life as a kid, the guitar was a haven for Lennon. I would say that he needed that guitar more than any of the other Beatles needed whatever instrument they were playing. Ringo Starr, he had a need for the drums because he was always in hospital, and it was the idea of being able to drum and maybe get a drum kit because they're so expensive at some point. It helped keep him going when he was being left behind at school, when he didn't have friends, and he was always sick. And I think about that now when you see all of these examples of his obvious robust health. I think it's like, okay, well, that came around. He deserved that after everything he went through as a kid. But Hamburg sharpened them all up. But we also have to remember that Hamburg, they didn't get Ringo Starr in the band, that crucial last piece, until their last residency there. So that's going to be the end of 1962, and they're off and running as doing their Conquer England thing by 63, and then, of course, the States in early 64. But I think the guitar meant so much to Lennon and the person he was. I think it gave him an outlet for what he deemed as his freakishness, which wasn't actually freakishness.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. There are some terrific early examples of Lennon's work. You mentioned Long Tall Sally being a really good example of it.
That's where we do get a Lennon solo, and Lennon solos are not the norm throughout the Beatles' oeuvre. When we get them, sometimes they're what we would expect, but they don't sound necessarily the way we anticipate them sounding. Some are quite surprising stylistically, and we'll get to that. But Long Tall Sally, the Little Richard number sung by Paul McCartney, is one of those songs that has multiple guitar solos, which the Beatles didn't do very often. The first one is by Lennon, and the second one is by Harrison. So you get the back-to-back contrast of these two players. And Lennon wasn't a huge Little Richard guy. Little Richard was always McCartney's guy, sort of gets divvied up that way. And Chuck Berry was more Lennon's guy. We only have Little Queenie that McCartney is going to sing from the Berry output. But they must have both loved this song. It was one of the earliest of the of the rock and roll hits in Britain. And Little Richard and his alleged freakishness represented something important, too, to a John Lennon, something to empathize with, that this outsider was having success and was making money, and that's what Lennon wanted to do. So he really lays into it with that first guitar solo. And the second guitar solo by Harrison, I think he was kind of jazzed by hearing Lennon do what Lennon had did. And you're competitive if you're any good. These guys were good. They were competitive with each other. Normally, that's Lennon and McCartney as songwriters, and then Harrison wanting in on that. But here you have two guys being competitive as guitarists, and it works out well for everyone.
And a whole lot of Lennon on another early recording, I'm Happy Just to Dance With You.
Again, it's the rhythm guitar, and so people wouldn't even notice this. There's no solo in the song, and A Hard Day's Night is an album where it doesn't happen the way it happens without Lennon's guitar contributions. Now, normally, that's going to be an acoustic guitar, but he has this iron-fisted grip on his guitar, his electric guitar, the Rickenbacker, for this particular number sung by George Harrison. And it's really what drives the song. The entire drive of the song, which he looked at as a throwaway, not really a throwaway, and which is sung at least competently by George Harrison. But the entire drive of the song is that rhythm guitar. The song doesn't work. Like, if someone covered this song just as a song, it's not going to hold up the way that the Beatles version does, because they're not going to have the Lennon guitar contribution.
What's Lennon's role in that incredible chord that opens A Hard Day's Night?
Everyone is in on that. And Lennon, the writer, would be coming up with guitar parts. Now, he didn't normally write, it sounds strange because he was often writing on guitar, but he didn't write to the instrument, I would say. Something like Eric Clapton, when he would write something, he would write to his instrument. It makes a certain amount of sense. Lennon didn't build a lot of songs around, for instance, riffs. Keith Richards would, but Lennon didn't work that way. And maybe that's why his songs resonate now, is more sophisticated often than guitar-based riffage type of songs. But once he had the idea for A Hard Day's Night, the song, which was, again, competition, they knew that was going to be the name of the film, so someone had to write the song. Lennon raced home from the studio, because at that time, he hadn't checked out like he would later. He was carrying the bulk of the weight on the sled. He wanted to get this songwriting, well, they would share the credit, but he wanted the actual credit for the song over Paul McCartney. And so once he came up with that idea for the opening chord, they all worked on that. It's not just one person playing that chord in the studio either. It's all of this going into the mixture that makes that Zeitgeist-defining opening to that song. But it's a very frantic, guitar-driven, electric. It's like almost more electric than electricity, that number. It has an energy. And it's right there from that opening chord.
And what do we get from Lennon on You Can't Do That?
That's another one on the Hard Day's Night album where he's on electric. And so much of A Hard Day's Night is, it's the Beatles, this is in the book I'm writing about it, it's the Beatles' lone skiffle album. Skiffle would have all of these disparate instruments made to go together. And that's what you get on A Hard Day's Night on so many tracks because of the Lennon acoustic guitar. He's the only one playing acoustically. It's plugged in, obviously, but still an acoustic guitar. You Can't Do That is not acoustic in any way. And it has this Lennon guitar solo on it that is just, it's punkish, it's scabrous, it's not euphonic, it's aggressive, and it mirrors the lyrical content of the song. So it's a version of text painting, I'd say, without any text, and doing it with the guitar, which is a neat trick. We don't have a lot of examples of that.
Now, I think Day Tripper's got one of the best riffs that the Beatles ever put together. Where's Lennon in that?
I think it's the best riff, period, in all of rock and roll. It's just the ultimate riff to me. And they didn't write a lot of songs. You can find examples. I Feel Fine, I Want You, She's So Heavy. But they didn't write a ton of songs based around the riff. Whereas if we go through with the Rolling Stones, we can do one after another, not all, of course, but many. This is sort of the Lennon song in his prime that he wrote entirely around a riff. McCartney is going to sing the parts of the vocal that require the higher register, but Lennon did the bulk of this writing. So it's his idea. He was writing to the guitar on this, and they knew that they had this killer riff. So that's more than him playing, that's Harrison playing the riff, that's him playing the riff, and McCartney's doubling it on bass. But it just goes to show that he could think in terms of guitar-based composition when he wanted to. We just don't really associate Lennon with that, but then he comes out with this mega guitar riff song for the ages that is paired with We Can Work It Out, is double A-side. And I mean, it's probably the second best single in rock and roll history. December 3rd, 1965. You go to the record shop, you get that, you get Rubber Soul on the same day. It's a good trip to the woodwork.
Honey Pie from the White Album is an interesting one because Lennon, it seemed that Lennon was not always crazy about it when McCartney would come in with songs that were throwbacks to the music that they grew up with, the old music hall style. And yet Lennon takes lead guitar on Honey Pie.
It's him. You really wouldn't expect him to be on the song like he is. It makes you wonder that if McCartney, being something of a politician, kind of, it was a stop to Lennon, because it's not, like you said, it's not Lennon's kind of song at all. I wonder that if he said to him, it's, oh yeah, I really need your style of guitar playing on this, because it's a tongue-in-cheek reference to that kind of granny music that Lennon derided. But Lennon, he's the guitarist on it. And he sounds like he's having a blast. He sounds like he's having fun. When he solos, and he's mimicking. I think it's this is why. Lennon, like so many brilliant creative people, was often in touch, I don't think he ever really left it, with his childhood. And he grew up with so many different forms of music around him. I mean, the BBC just would have brought so many forms of radio and music entertainment into your life. And the Beatles were all, Lennon especially, were huge BBC kids. They were really into that. So I think this, in a way, for all of his protestations about the kind of music sometimes McCartney wanted to make at this point of their career, I think Lennon liked going back to that that time in his life, for those early musical awakenings of his life. And so I think he sounds like a man glad to be playing what he's playing on this song. And his guitar solo has a tone unlike any you'll hear anywhere else from him. I can't think of anything else that he played that sounds remotely like Honey Pie.
Also, another interesting song from the White Album, Lennon's shot at writing a blues song that was in many ways, I think he even referred to it as a parody of a blues song, Your Blues.
Yeah, I wrote about this once for the Daily Beast, I think it was. It's up in the Beatles section on my website, and it's one of the other numbers where we have the back-to-back guitar solo approach, where it's Lennon going first and Harrison with all these different pedal effects going second. Lennon's solo, he almost drives the song to a halt. Like, he's trying to bury the song in the ground. He's playing extremely fast. He's like going back to that triplets type of speed of All My Loving, so many beats per minute. But again, it's just this jagged, abrading, intense. It is a faux blues. It's a satire blues, but there's nothing faux or satirical about his guitar solo.
And I think some of the best instrumental work the Beatles did came on Get Back. It's such a pulsing, driving song, and everybody made great contributions to that.
Especially up on the roof. If you listen to the rooftop concert from January 30th, 1969, everybody's milling about, setting up, and listen to maybe some other live rock and roll albums by other groups first. And then you get to the Beatles, and the milling about stops, and they're going to start with Get Back. It's like four bars. Not even before you think, okay, these guys, winners, they just have it. But it's another song like Honey Pie where you wouldn't expect the primary guitarist, guy playing all those guitar solos, there always seems to be like a guitar solo in Get Back, even when there isn't one, it's kind of a neat effect, is Lennon. And again, you just wonder how that was worked out, because it's McCartney's song, Harrison was playing well at the time, and it's going to Lennon. He had a knack for playing in a simple way that didn't leave you wanting for more. He's not using the scabrous tone on Get Back. It's a song that has to have movement to it. There's movement in the concept of the song. There's movement in the lyric of what's happening here. And it's not a stationary song. So it has to have its own sort of, not a wispiness, but it has to have a lightness to it, a buoyancy, a moving on, a going from hither to yon. And Lennon captures that perfectly with his guitar play.
Well, some of the best guitar work the Beatles did came on Abbey Road, the medley that wraps up the album. And what we're going to do is play some of that and let you, we'll keep the volume down a little bit on it so you can kind of tell us who's who on this one as everybody gets their solo. And we pick it up about 35 seconds in. Let's give a listen.
The Ring of Stars just wrapped up its solo there. We have the guitar refrain. In fact, I love you or yeah, you being sung in the background. McCartney soloing. Harrison soloing. Lennon is singing. McCartney, Harrison, here comes Lennon. Now we have McCartney coming up for one last pass. Harrison, now listen to this, Lennon. I mean, you get nine guitar solos, each is about 2 bars long. You see the different stylistic hallmarks, and then we have the final musical moment of consequence in the final Beatles record, instrumentally speaking, that is, before we're going to get the famous couplet at the end. And John Lennon takes the last guitar solo, and that's meaningful. This was his band. It was he who started it, and they always looked at it as his band, even when he was checked out. So there's a deference there. There's a respect, but it also works out musically. And the girlfriends and wives were around when that was recorded, and they were part of the retinue, whether people liked it or they didn't like it at that point. Lennon was one of the ones who, of course, wanted Yoko Ono around. And when they were going to record what you just heard, they started to go off, the guys. And he turned and he said, it's just going to be us. And it was sort of going back to what they were doing in the first place. But those 2 bars of his concluding solo, that is my favorite guitar solo of all time. He just drives that thing through like the middle of the earth. It's awesome.
And even though it wasn't Beatles, it was recorded around the same time his work in the late 60s with the Plastic Ono Band. He's got the only guitar on that.
Sure. So this is coming out in 1970, and you could make the argument, this is the only Beatles solo album that's worth a damn. You'll find moments on the others. To me, one of the huge knocks on the Beatles is that these guys didn't really do too much that was amazing after they left their 20s. That leaves a lot of your life, not so much in Lennon's case, but enough time. But this is the album that holds up the best as a work of art that any of the solo Beatles made. And it's minimalist instrumentally, and I guess we could say maximalist in terms of emotional outpouring of pain. But John Lennon's a rocker, and he's always going to have the guitar be his main go-to instrument. I know Imagine and all that, but his heart's not in Imagine the way it is in the guitar and in rock and roll and in Plastic Ono Band. I think that's obvious. So he's skilled enough as a guitarist, or he's able to do enough of what he needs to do to be the only guitar voice on a canonical record, which is what Plastic Ono Band is.
Can't wait for the Beatles book, Colin. It's going to be great.
Oh, I appreciate that, sir.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday. What? I don't have my list. What are we talking about next week? Do you remember?
I think we are talking about cool children shows that also have appeal for adults that are typically from Britain in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, but I am not sure.
All right. Well, that either way, it'll be great, but that sounds wonderful. Looking forward to it. We'll catch you next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
That is Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Check out the website, colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog.